Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 22, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call and a special Courthouse Steps edition. Today, we will be discussing the Horn case re-argued this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back to Teleforum a return guest, John Elwood. He is a partner at Vinson & Elkins right here in Washington, D.C. He attended oral argument this morning, and he's going to begin with opening remarks, giving us some general background on the case, talking about procedurally how it's gone up to the court, back down, and now back up again, and probably, hopefully, give us some predictions. Sometimes our guests are reluctant to do that, but we'll see if he will venture a prediction. Those opening remarks we think might be 10 to 15 minutes or so, but then, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mr. Elwood, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. If you're on this call, you already know that this case involves the federal raisin marketing order, which was implemented by the Department of Agriculture under the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act of 1937. Congress enacted the AMAA during the Great Depression in an effort, and this is taken from the government's brief in this case, in an effort to insulate farmers from competitive market forces that it believed caused unreasonable fluctuation in supplies and prices, unquote. So it's a classic New Deal program to sort of tamp down what they viewed as destructive effects of competition in the market. And the government brief recounts how prices rose and fell in the raisin market in particular as people increased their acreage as they're supposed to when prices are high, and thus caused the prices to respond as you would expect them to by falling thereafter. The raising marketing order was put in place in 1949. The government argues it's necessary because although demand is stable at about 211,000 tons of raisins per year, and it is inelastic, people don't want any more raisins than that, supply can be highly variable because the type of grapes that are used can also be used for other items, and so people can, you know, put them into the raisin market and thus cause, you know, really bumper crops in some years. And they, you know, talk about how in 1 year it may be 240,000 tons, and in the next year it is 430,000 tons, you know, nearly twice as much. So the raisin marketing order gives the Raisin Administrative Committee the ability to limit the amount of raisins that will be sold by handlers in the domestic market. Producers give their raisins to handlers, and then the Raisin Administrative Committee says, you know what, you can only sell, you know, 240,000 tons of those this year, and everything else you got to hold in reserve. And the reserve stuff is titled in the name of the government, even though it stays in the hands of the handlers. It is titled to the government, and they hold on to it. At that point, you know, the raisin handlers only pay the producers, generally speaking, for what is they called the free tonnage, the stuff that they're allowed to sell, and the rest of it they don't get paid for. Then the Raisin Administrative Committee essentially trickles out the rest of the raisins as the market will bear, you know, for school lunch programs or selling them for export, usually at a pretty substantially reduced price. And the Raisin Administrative Committee first pays administrative costs with the money that they make out of that, and then they return whatever is left over to the farmers. To give an example of how this works, you know, overall, and 2002, 2003, which is one of the 2 years at issue in this case, 47% of the crop was held in reserve. So literally almost half the crop was titled to the government. That year, they were paid the farmers were paid far below the cost of production on fair market value. The following year, the government took 30%, and they were actually paid nothing because the administrative expenses were very, very high. But in the interest of fairness, for I believe the next 5 years, there were no reserves. That is, that they just didn't vote to have a reserve. The Raisin Administrative Committee didn't, and it was more or less free market or free market-ish. and that there are years with much lighter reserves as well. But it sounds generally from the argument today that reserves have been declared much more sparingly. The horns at issue in this case, they attempted to avoid the order, which, as I say, only applies to handlers, thinking that if the they are raisin producers, if they sold directly to wholesalers, they wouldn't be subject to that reserve and losing the portion of the crop. So they essentially kind of handled it themselves, and they made their own raisins with their own equipment and sold it off directly, and then they leased the stuff to their neighbors, more or less, who did the same deal. And the USDA came after them more or less and said, aha, you guys are handlers, and you know, we're going to take some of those raisins. And the horns wouldn't do that, so then the USDA essentially said, you got to pay a fine equivalent to that set aside. And in that regard, even though ordinarily handlers or people classified as handlers only pay for the free market raisins, the free tonnage, in this case, the horns wound up having to pay for everybody. And the producers got 100 cents on the dollar. They were paid for all of the raisins they sold, you know, using the horns equipment. And so the horns made out worse than most handlers do. So in any event, during an enforcement proceeding, the horns sought judicial review through the district court. When the USDA came after them for the fine, the horns said, this is a taking for you to try to take this the fine equivalent of the raisins from us, and they tried to interpose that as a constitutional defense. And the district court granted the USDA summary judgment. And in the first go-round, Ninth Circuit, a panel of Hawkins, Gould, and Reinhart held that it lacked jurisdiction over the defense, that it was an uncompensated per se taking. And they said that, that what the horns needed to do was pay the fine and then go seek a refund in the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act. And the Supreme Court on the first go-round said that was loopy, more or less, and said you should be able to challenge the constitutionality in district court before you're required to comply. And so they sent it back. On remand, it was the same panel of the Ninth Circuit. And as a little wrinkle, which I have spared you thus far, before the Ninth Circuit said they lacked jurisdiction, they actually held the way they did on remand, more or less. That is, they entered an order holding for the government on the merits, then said, well, we don't have jurisdiction after all. And on remand, they more or less entered something like the original opinion, which said that that per se takings doctrine doesn't apply to personal property, it only applies to real property. And then they said, because the horns retained benefits flowing from the use of raisins by the Raisin Administrative Committee, and they had a contingent right to the proceeds that wasn't spent by the Raisin Administrative Committee, the horns did not lose all economically valuable use of their personal property, and thus the Ninth Circuit held it wasn't a taking. They said more or less that it was a use restriction rather than a physical taking, and that it satisfied the nexus and rough proportionality rule applied to land use exactions under Nolan versus California Coastal Commission, a 1987 decision of the Supreme Court, and Dolan versus City of Tigard, a 1994 decision of the court. And that pretty much brings us to this, the second go-around. The horns petitioned for cert again. The government opposed it again. And I think somewhat surprisingly, the court granted cert a second time. On its second trip to the court, it raises three questions. First, it raises the question whether this is as framed by the petitioner. I haven't attempted to make these more neutral. Whether the categorical duty to pay just compensation when the government physically takes possession of an interest in property applies only to real property and not to personal property. That's the first question. The second question, whether the government can avoid the categorical duty to pay just compensation by reserving a contingent interest in a portion of the value of the property, which is set at the government's discretion. And then finally, third, whether a governmental mandate to relinquish specific identifiable property as a condition on permission to engage in commerce affects a per se taking. Those are the three questions. Brings us to argument today. There was a lot of amicus participation, particularly on the challenger's side. There were quite a number of briefs, including one that I filed on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce. I will try to keep my own biases out of this anyway. There were only two briefs filed, I believe, on behalf of the government, though. One of them for Sun Made Raisins, who is, I think, arguably a beneficiary of this order, or at least many of their producers are. We'll see. So the petitioner's lawyer was former judge and current Stanford professor Michael McConnell, who definitely had an easier time today, although he had his own challenges too. Ed Needler, who I think may be the active lawyer who has the most arguments, had real trouble getting traction. He was the lawyer on behalf of the government who argued the case. The court's more liberal members were the only people who really had sharp questions from McConnell, who received friendly questions from Justices Scalia and Alito, and importantly, Justice Kennedy, who is, you know, widely seen as a bellwether, and he doesn't dissent very many times. Initially, McConnell had really tough sledding with questions about how he had grounds to complain if, as he recognized, the government could impose volume restrictions. Right out of the gate, Justice Ginsburg said, you agree that the government could say you can only sell 60% of your crop. You know, why wouldn't that deprive you of all value? Whereas, under this, you get at least some value, at least a contingent interest, and the return of some value of the raisins that are held back. And he initially had trouble getting traction on that argument. You know, Sotomayor followed up with a question, suggesting that his complaint boiled down to the Raisin Administrative Committee having excessively high administrative costs, because that's the part that they lose is whatever amount that the Raisin Administrative Committee spends on themselves and thus doesn't return to producers. But over time, McConnell gradually made headway, noting that the problem was that their raisins were taken, and that there are plenty of agricultural programs where the producers might say you can only sell 60% of your crop, but they would gradually be allowed to sell the rest of it over time, and thus would get all the value of it. And more importantly, that portion of their crop wouldn't be taken. And he had a lot of trouble with that at first, but over time, I think that he, made that point to the justices. I think it's a bad sign for the government that several justices, including Justice Kagan and the Chief Justice, and I think Justice Sotomayor, I left my notes at work and I am now at home, sought during the government's argument to determine how many other programs might be vulnerable if this program is struck down. The answer they got was a handful of programs, like 8 or 10, and then it might, affect a score, although he was fairly vague about that. But I think the thing that is going to hurt the government here is that Ed Needler suggested that most of those programs hadn't used the reserve program in like a decade. And another bad sign, I think, for the government is that Justice Sotomayor asked what the statute of limitations was on takings claims. It's 6 years. And then asked whether any reserve programs had been used during that period, and the answer seemed to be no, suggesting that the court would feel like it was a fairly low-cost proposition to say these sort of reserve programs are a per se taking, because Uncle Sam wouldn't be out a ton of money for that. It would just be that the Horns could use it as a defense. Ed Needler kept emphasizing that if the petitioners are right, that there has been a per se taking in many years since 1949, which he seemed to think was, an amazing thing to contemplate. But the court seemed relatively unconcerned, I think in part because the statute of limitations has run for virtually all of that. Justice Kagan, who during the first argument mused about whether this was, quote, a takings or it's just the world's most outdated law, unquote, returned to the idea that the court wasn't passing on whether the program, the Raisin Set-Aside program made sense, and that the case could be upheld even if it were a ridiculous program. When Justice Scalia cracked a joke how it certainly didn't help that it was ridiculous, she said, no, this is a serious point, that it may not work all that well, but that the government still has the power to do it. We're not passing on whether it's a sensible program. We're only passing on whether this is an unconstitutional takings. Kagan and Ginsburg and Sotomayor emphasized other programs that were found not to be takings in the past, including, I think it's Leonard versus Earl, involving a requirement that oyster packers in Maryland turn over 10% of their empty shells to the government, and a case where Monsanto had to give up trade secrets in order to produce pesticides. McConnell defended the first as a tax, and also, you know, that was an instance where you were catching wild animals, where the government essentially owned them, Maryland essentially owned them, and thus it could, you know, give you as much or as little property right as it wanted in them. And that also Monsanto was different because of the hazards, which is something that Justice Scalia, who I think was the most outspoken of the justices in favor of the challengers here, that was something that he picked up on, that, you know, sure, you might regulate the entry of pesticides into commerce, but not raisins. Justice Breyer was perhaps the most staunch defender of the government's program in some sense, but I don't think he was giving the government the kind of help it really needed, because he was Breyer was more along the lines of saying that, well, it's a takings. The benefits that producers get under the program in the form of higher prices from reducing output at any one time, and in the return of payments from what the government sells, is just compensation. And the government is trying to say that there's no taking here. It's just a form of regulation. And, you know, McConnell was having trouble making headway on this argument at first, and he acknowledged that in a general sense that this might be a type of in-kind regulation in-kind compensation when you get benefits from a program and you also get paid something back. But by the time of his rebuttal over the course of the argument, it appeared that he was finally getting traction with one of his arguments, basically that because this arose in the context of an enforcement proceeding and not some sort of, you know, condemnation proceeding or inverse condemnation proceeding, that it simply there wasn't an outlet for this kind of idea that it was in-kind compensation. And he cited to the regulation, which he gave them the number, and it was clear that people were writing it down, that in this kind of enforcement proceeding, you know, that there's just no room for in-kind compensation. The chief justice, who sometimes plays his cards very close to his vest, as in the second Obamacare argument that was recently held, was unusually outspoken and I think critical of the government's program. He and Scalia both referred to the program as a taking, and not in the sense that it was a position they seemed to be trying on for size, but that they thought that was really the case. I believe that Breyer also kind of referred to it as a taking, but I think that was more of a trying it on for size, like, you know, say it's a taking, then this is still just compensation. But they seemed to, you know, be willing to say right out there in the open in front of God and everybody that this was a taking. The chief also emphasized that this was this program was something of an outlier, to suggest that this wasn't something that would cause problems for other programs. He said, quote, "We are not going to jeopardize the Agricultural Department's marketing programs," unquote. And I think that there was a certain level of unconcern, because the justices felt like even if this program is struck down, there will be enough room to regulate. I don't know if you've seen Lyle Denniston's analysis, which seemed very critical of the justices, saying that, you know, that they were, that the imagery had overwhelmed their command of the facts. I think the justices had just fine command of the facts of this case, but it was just they were not that concerned because they feel like they can strike down this program, or the majority of them feels like they can strike down this program and it won't affect the government's other ability to regulate. Because I certainly think that the justices do care about the ability to regulate. Before I saw argument today, I thought that Justice Kennedy would be a big question mark, because even though he's a huge free speech guy, he was a guy who upheld cable set-asides for broadcast TV because he thought that was regulation. And, you know, if he thought that this was valid regulation, he might be willing to let it go as well. But I think based on argument today, he is skeptical as well. Also, you know, the chief made a joke. He said, you know, you went after the raisins and you probably would have done it in the dark of night, which I think was meant as a joke. The chief also talked about how, you know, if the government's position is right, they could order manufacturers to turn over, you know, one-third of cell phones or one-fifth of cars that are produced and and require manufacturers to give those to people who couldn't afford them, on the theory that that was expanding the market for people and that those people were serving as advertisements. And, you know, Ed Kneedler just didn't have an opportunity really to effectively engage that. I don't know if he would have a good rebuttal of that, but he just didn't engage that. Kennedy, too, was also, you know, a little sarcastic. I don't remember his remarks, but he did use a little gentle sarcasm, which is unusual for him. and I think also as a way of sort of showing his hand. You know, he didn't seem all that concerned about disrupting the government's program. He, you know, summarized his version of the government's argument to McConnell, which obviously is comes across as much more of a friendly question when you're essentially asking a litigant to characterize their opponent's argument. And during the rebuttal, he intervened to protect McConnell's rebuttal time when his colleagues, mostly liberal ones, were asking questions. He said, "You only have 4 minutes. Are there other points you want to make?" Basically allowing him to return to his track after asking Justice Sotomayor's question. I think clearly, if you go through the questions that are being that they presented to the court, I think there is no question that the court is going to hold that personal property is generally subject to per se takings analysis. Not even the government really defended that, and it seemed that there was broad consensus that that was the case. Even Justice Breyer, you know, seemed to be an available vote for that. I also feel like on the question about whether the government can avoid a categorical duty to pay just compensation by reserving a contingent interest in a portion of the value of the property, I think that that is going to be, you know, it seems by my lights to be an easy win for the challengers. I can see, you know, at least a 5-4 vote with the traditional more conservative justices versus the more liberal ones. It seemed to be easy, you know, Kennedy joining the conservatives with Breyer and Kagan seeming like available votes, and maybe even Justice Sotomayor being an available vote for a position if narrowly written. And, you know, when you talk about total speculation, looking at the argument calendar for this month, there are only 7 cases. And assuming, you know, that Justice Kennedy were to take the authorship of the majority in the same-sex marriage case, and Justice Scalia takes the opinion in the re-argument of the Armed Career Criminal Act case, I could see the Chief Justice writing an opinion in this case and writing it narrowly enough and, you know, twisting arms enough, because he's always trying to emphasize the importance of unanimity to get potentially even a unanimous opinion, although I think that'd be tougher sledding. One other thing I think that is important to think about is exactly what they will hold, because, you know, this is an enforcement proceeding that is involving individuals who are, you know, potentially on the hook for a lot of money against the government. And the chief is, you know, enough of an on-the-ball guy that he may appreciate that it would be good to bring this case to close once and for all and decide all the issues so that there's basically no need for a remand. But that is, I think, one of the big things to watch on remand, because a decision that wraps everything up would be a really big win for the Horns. They would be out of the case. And, you know, one other thing is that the chief goes for kind of middle dispositions frequently, and so it's also a possibility that he might hand something of a loss to the government but remand for a determination of exactly how much of a loss it is. But that remains to be seen. And with that, I'm happy to take your questions.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Mr. Elwood. Let's open it up to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our experts, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to questions, let me remind folks that our schedule next week includes calls on the gay marriage case, which is being argued next week, the same-sex marriage case, but also a case, the Glossop case on Thursday, which concerns the death penalty and the cocktail for executing folks. That'll be on the calendar next week. Do check the Federal Society's website for updates, as the calendar is somewhat fluid. Today, let's take our first call.
Hello, this is Tony Francois with Pacific Legal Foundation. It sounds like there was then absolutely no discussion of the Nolan-Dolan analysis that the Ninth Circuit applied to the case. Did any of the justices ask about that?
You know, there really was not. There was really not a lot of, I can't remember any questions about whether, you know, how this would fare under Nolan-Dolan. It all seemed to be, Yeah, you know, talking about whether it was a per se takings, and every time, you know, Ed Kneedler tried to discuss how this was really a regulatory program, he more or less was cut off with another question. And so, you know, when you're talking about whether the game is played in, you know, your side or the other side, this was definitely played on the right side of the field for the challengers because it got zero attention.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Let me ask a quick question of you, John Elwood. You mentioned in your opening remarks other like programs, questions by the justices from the bench about other like programs, how numerous they were, statutes of limitations. In other words, how much exposure the government might have here and how much government programming the court might be undoing in finding for the challengers here. Are you disheartened by the fact that it seems the court's contemplating whether or not there's a violation of the Constitution, and part of that calculation is how much law they're going to have to undo to enforce the Constitution? And you could also almost make an argument that the more pervasive these programs are, if unconstitutional, the more dire the need for the court to act and act pretty decisively.
Well, this is one thing, is that since I'm a practitioner rather than an academic, it bugs me less when they are, you know, obviously very practical-minded. I think the charitable way of putting it would be that, you know, not that they would be that they would stop from doing the right thing if they thought that a bunch of programs were unconstitutional, but just that they want to pay, you know, closer attention when they're going to be breaking a lot of china. You know, that is the thing, is that it seemed that they could be fairly, you know, I don't want to say cavalier because I don't think they were being cavalier, but they were definitely, there was sort of a palpable feeling that they were, that they did not view this as being a difficult choice for them because it wasn't going to cause a lot of disruption. I think that there are a lot of them who feel like these agricultural programs are probably, you know, not very sensible regulation, that are committed to the idea that the government generally can regulate, even if they think the regulation is stupid. But I think that they thought there were enough other opportunities for the Department of Agriculture to get its job done, that they did seem sort of palpably unconcerned about that.
Are there any echoes of the Kelo case, the decision in which the of just a few years ago, where there was such a, I don't know if backlash is the right word, but such a reaction from the public on the court's decision in that case. Is that at all on the minds of the court here, do you think?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was somewhat on their minds and that they're somewhat sensitive to that, because there was a tremendous backlash to that. But I think it may be, you know, there's been enough turnover on the court since then. I would be, you know, I forget who all was in the majority on that court, but it may be that enough people have changed that, you know, that it's just a different majority at this point.
All right. Once again, if you have a question for John Elwood, our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call from our audience.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Were there any arguments made in any of the briefs about the history of the takings clause, the historical background? I've researched that, and I find that the main impetus for the takings clause was personal property and not real property. It concerned things like troops in the field either destroying or taking property from people to conduct their operations, and the people not getting paid for it. So
there definitely was a fair amount of emphasis on that. That it was a fairly clear historical case for the fact, for exactly the point that you're making. That you know, that it was you know, troops taking food and, you know, means of transport, carts. That was the impetus for the clause. And indeed, there was one brief filed by, I think, Tim Bishop at Mayor Brown that I think mentioned Magna Carta something like 52 times, because the court used a hypothetical that our brief mentioned, and when I went through to see if anybody else mentioned Cars, I discovered how many people had discussed Magna Carta. So, yes, there was a lot of talk of in the briefing, at least, about historical arguments, but it was such an accepted position, it seemed to be broadly accepted, that personal property would be subject to per se takings, that it simply wasn't discussed at oral argument today.
We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to another call.
John, this is Richard Klingler from Sidley Austin. I thought that was a very good and incisive summary. Appreciate that. I wonder, though, whether either in the argument or in the course of the case, there's been an effort to inject a due process challenge to the program itself. That is a libertarian claim that there's really no rational or substantial basis to limit the Horn's liberty interest.
You know, I think that there may be kind of a feeling of that, or there may be the argument kind of developing, but I think it's unlikely that the court will address that. It may be that there is enough of a headwind that, you know, when you get these kind of overwhelming wins, like you did in the Sackett case, sometimes there will be concurring opinions that are useful for developing the law. Like you might remember in the Sackett case, which was just a complete blowout, Justice Alito filed a concurring opinion in which he suggested that not only was, you know, when the government, you know, tells you to fill in some land or whatever, that is an actionable order, you know, for purposes of going into court, but just merely the government's assertion of regulatory of Clean Water Act authority is enough to get you into court, which is a position that I understand, I think the Eighth Circuit recently adopted. I think that in a case where it is kind of either lopsided or at least very enthusiastic support, that you might get concurring opinions that lay the basis for, you know, more far-reaching programmatic challenges.
Thanks.
We've got three questions pending. Let's take another call here.
Yes, sir. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm a Federalist Society member. Looking at the 1978 Penn Central decision as, you know, seen as establishing greater coherence to the traditional ad hoc analysis approach that the courts have used in takings cases, do you think that a possible ruling in this case going for the petitioner may establish maybe further coherence to that process, say by creating new tests, perhaps?
I think that there is a real chance of that. The chief, I think, is sensitive to exactly how much of a morass the takings law is. It may be something that he feels like he needs to, you know, balance because he likes broad majorities. And if he does too much to sort of carve away at or limit Penn Central and some of the other cases, I could see that that might lose votes. But it is, you know, something that people are cognizant of. And I know the Chamber of Commerce amicus brief emphasized that, you know, how difficult it is for people to have to litigate under Nolan Dolan and under the Penn Central test. And, you know, that is something that is recognized not just by, you know, conservatives, but is recognized by pretty much a broad swath of property law academics. Mm-hmm. So I think that that is something that could be done, you know, if one of the justices is of a mind to do it.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
We've got two questions pending. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a bit of time left. Let's take another call now.
Hello. This is Arthur Hellman in Pittsburgh. I missed the first part of this, so maybe you answered the question. Lyle Denniston's report on the oral argument reports a comment by the Chief Justice to the effect that we're not going to jeopardize the Agriculture Department's marketing programs. And I wonder if you see that as countering the generally pro-plaintiff trend of the questions.
Well, I think the way I viewed that is that the chief painted this as kind of an outlier program. And because it is an outlier program, there, you know, the are only, by the government's estimate, there are like 8 to 10 other programs that are like this. that the justices thought they could safely strike this down without breaking too much China. And, you know, this was a big question mark for me because, you know, as much as I feel like, for example, Justice Kennedy might be sympathetic to the claims of petitioners that they wouldn't want to hamstring the government's ability to regulate too much in this area because, you know, even if people may have personal disagreements with how USDA regulates, they feel like it is their job to, you know, leave the Department of Agriculture as much regulatory authority as it's entitled to. That's all I read into that, that they sort of feel like this program is an outlier, and if this program isn't functioning, you know, correctly, they would have no compunction in striking it down because it won't have a lot of effects outside a fairly narrow swath of programs.
I guess to follow up, I guess this just shows my own ignorance. You mentioned there was something like 8 to 10 like this. There must be then lots and lots of other programs for other commodities. Are there? What do you have any sense of what the number is? Is it scores, dozens?
Yes, scores is exactly the term that the government lawyer used. And I don't know whether by design or just because he wasn't prepared enough, that was a question that the Chief Justice explicitly asked him. Like, you know, you say 8 to 10, that is out of how many? And the answer, I think, did nothing to sort of cool the justices who favored the challengers down any bit because they said it was 8 to 10 out of scores and scores. So it is a relatively small proportion of the programs that are structured like the current one. And as an aside also, it was interesting to me that the government emphasized how few times they're actually using reserve programs, which may be that even if these programs on the whole are kind of a relic of the New Deal, that the boards that are, you know, elected from producers seem to be taking, at least if you believe the government's characterization of it, they seem to be taking a lighter hand nowadays.
Well, thank you. It's gratifying to know that the Chief Justice anticipated my question. Thank you very much.
Well, great minds think alike.
I'd like to think so.
We've got just one question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's take another call here.
Yes, Alden Abbott Heritage. I also attended the oral argument, and thanks for the excellent summary. One commentator earlier mentioned due process. I mean, I do think Justice Breyer did spend a little bit of time trying to come up with a rational explanation for the program, saying the problem of inelastic demand, price swings, protecting, at least ostensibly protecting that particular agricultural sector, and so forth. But what was interesting is there was absolutely no mention of a public use of which everyone bemoaned its death and still seems to be on dead, if not on life support, because one could view this as instead of, you know, taking, if property was taken, to not to create a park, but to benefit certain members of a private industry while imposing harm on other industries, that is the cereal makers who buy raisins and the general public. So it's something that was quite striking to me, and I didn't really read the amicus briefs, but I wonder, was the issue of public use saying, by the way, the public use issue is being ignored here? Did that ever come up? It obviously didn't come up in the oral argument.
You know, that's a good question. I don't remember reading about that in the briefs, but that is a good point, and maybe that is a tie-in with Kilo. Is that it is kind of an attenuated public use claim now that you mention it. And when you also consider that, you know, I mean, at least the cereal producers get to pass that cost along to the consumers, but it is ultimately the consumers who are on the receiving end of this program. You know, when they talk about the millions of dollars which they have, extra dollars that they've earned for producers, that's also millions of dollars that they've taken from consumers who are, you know, from raising consumers. But yeah, it is an interesting thing, and it is another telling thing that you know, even years after that, the landmark case and the backlash from it, Kilo, that public use does seem to be a fairly moribund concept, or at least it is elastic enough that it is at most a speed bump for these programs.
Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Mr. Elwood, while we're waiting to see if we get another question or two, let me ask you, rarely do we have somebody make such a confident prediction about the outcome of a case. And you mentioned the possibility of a 5-4 decision in favor of the challengers, also the possibility that the Chief Justice could write and go for a unanimous decision. I wonder if you could say a few words about what the effect of a 5-4 decision versus, a more narrow 9-0 decision, what the differences between those two opinions might be in a practical sense. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, it might matter some for the government because, you know, a 5-4 decision, the government might trim its sails enough that they feel like they could maybe get Justice Kennedy's vote or something, that they could rejigger the program slightly and do something more. But, you know, a 9-0 loss can be seen as a big rebuke and, you know, might really cause the government to reconsider. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, when the court has enough other hot-button issues going on, you do wonder what the calculus will be for the Chief Justice, you know, that is how much capital he has to spend to get votes for this case versus for other cases, and, you know, how much of his attention is going to be devoted to this as opposed to everything else. And it is a hot-button enough end of the term that you do wonder how much work he'll put into this. Although, you know, I have to say this is a pretty important case, and, you know, aside from the fact that the same-sex marriage case is coming down the pike, I think that there'd be a lot of attention lavished on this, and he has a long enough perspective as, you know, a long student of the court before he became a member, that I think that he will appreciate that this is an important decision and, you know, strive for coming up with a decision that is important in one dimension or another. And my personal hope is that just as somebody who has sort of suffered under the sort of lack of clarity that the balancing tests have, it would be great if he could, you know, use the opportunity to try to make some progress on that score and just improving clarity. But I have no particular, well, I may have been confident in the bottom line outcome. I have no particular confidence that that will happen.
Yeah, I mean, if you can say, is there more likely to be clarity in a 5-4 decision or less likely to be clarity in a 9-0 decision?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot to that. That, you know, with every additional vote, this is something that you appreciate. Like, I was amazed by, you know, how it can sometimes even be hard when you're clerking for a court of appeals judge, you know, how it can sometimes be hard just to get one more vote. And with every additional vote you have to get, there's greater and greater opportunities for disagreement, and you know, there's less and less that you are able to say without somebody getting off, especially on fairly hot button issues. You know, this started out as a pretty hot bench against you know, Judge McConnell when he was speaking, and you know, it does seem like there are areas where there is broader agreement. You know, where Justice Breyer seemed to agree, and Justice Kagan seemed to agree, and even Justice Sotomayor seemed to agree. But, you know, with every additional person, there is less and less, you know, area where there are Venn diagrams all overlap.
A couple audience questions now, so let's go to our next listener. Another question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, back again. Were there any arguments that may have cited or perhaps even argued, like as in NFIB v. Sebelius, that the necessary and proper clause applied to the Commerce Clause did not extend as far as the regulatory actions of the federal government? And was there any reply that it's actually all a tax, whether direct or indirect, on not doing something?
You know, I didn't read all of the amicus briefs thoroughly, so I don't know if it was in there, but it was not anything that was brought to my attention. There is, though, one of the cases which was cited by the Justices Kagan and I think Ginsburg and Sotomayor was this Leonard case, which was a case where they upheld that 10% of all shells, oyster shells, returned to the state, and they upheld it as a tax. So that was about the only appearance that the tax made, and, you know, the ability to do it. And I think that there wasn't it was when it was mentioned, though, McConnell mentioned the tax thing merely to say that you can't essentially, you know, they generally scoffed at the idea that it could be upheld on that ground here. It would, I guess, have to be, I guess it would probably be upheld under Commerce Clause grounds. But, that there was not much appetite for upholding that this or saying that the Agriculture Department got this authority through any sort of taxing power, although Kagan proposed that briefly.
We've got one question pending. Again, push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you'd like to join the conversation. Check in with another listener now.
Yeah, hi, this is Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. In recent kind of media accounts of the case, some of the people that are quoted are kind of talking about if the case goes against the horns or goes in favor of the horns, it could spell the end of marketing orders. The problem with that, I wanted to see what you thought about that, is there's about 29 marketing orders, and only, if we count, 10 have volume controls. And in about four or five of those volume controls are not even in effect at all. So you have maybe four or five marketing orders that have volume controls in effect. So as far as I can see, the only marketing orders that would be affected would be those four or five. And honestly, it seems like it would only affect the volume controls. So do you see this as just limited to those volume controls, or do you think it's broader than that?
No, I think that is right. And I mean, I think volume controls by themselves isn't even the problem. It's just the reserves, and that, you know, that you'd be, it seemed to be an article of faith that all parties accepted, including the challengers, that you could have even volume controls. It's just when they're enforced by the government taking title to the thing on which there is a volume restriction, that you would be, the government would even be within its rights to say, you know, hold on to, you can only sell 50%, you got to hold on to the other 47%, and we'll tell you when you can sell it. So it seemed like that even that would probably be permissible under challenger's formulation, although they might have other problems with that, but at least it wouldn't be a taking problem. And so, I don't think that it'll be, I think that it's unlikely to be written in a way that has, you know, very broad implications for a host of marketing orders. I think it will be relatively targeted, is the sense I got from the comments from the justices and from the government's lawyer.
But I suppose we might expect to see challenges to some other like programs, even if this decision pertains only to this program.
Verified.
I think that's definitely true. We're going to find out soon enough after this, after the decision in this case, what those other programs are. The government's lawyer was fairly vague on what those were. He didn't identify any of them, and it'll be interesting to see what those are.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you've got a question, we've got a few minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Darren Back, did you have more to say?
No, I'm kind of interested in the fact that the government attorney said there's scores and scores of programs. I assume he's talking about pretty much every USDA program, because there's only a certain number of marketing orders.
Right. Yeah. No. He suggested that there were a lot of marketing orders and very few that had reserve programs.
Yeah, there are a few that have the reserve programs that I would agree with, but not many more than 29. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
We do have another question from our audience, so let's take what could be our final question of the day.
Hi, this is Tony Francois again. The discussion on how many marketing orders this might affect, for those interested in it, there's actually a law review article from 1995 that reviews the existing marketing orders that appear to use this technique. It's 5 San Joaquin Agricultural Law Review 3 from 1995. It's an overview of the AMAA, and it actually lists the specific marketing orders that appear to use this technique. And there's certainly no more than 20, I don't think, in there.
That's a very useful. But you think that there might be even at that many that use the reserves?
Well, the article actually describes some federal litigation over citrus marketing orders, which resulted in those orders being discontinued, or at least the reserve being discontinued for most of the citrus orders in the 90s. And that had to do with errors that were made under the APA in the modification of those orders. And that was really the impetus for that article. But it lists some crops. There's also a completely separate federal statute that's described in that article that deals with milk. And there are many milk pooling statutes around the country at the state level, and then there's a federal program that controls those. And that's probably kind of the next step if there are follow-on cases of this type is, you know, how does a decision by the court in this case affect things like these milk pooling arrangements?
Interesting.
We do have still another question. Let's take another call.
Yeah, hi, this is Darren Bax from Heritage again. I'm sorry to call, have another question. By the way, I just was wondering, did you have the citation that you could repeat again for the article that was just mentioned?
It was, I didn't jot it down. Let me see.
That's okay.
It's 5 San Joaquin Agricultural Law Review, but I didn't get the pin page. I got the volume 5.
Yeah, I think it was 5 San Joaquin and then
yeah.
3.
Yeah,
the one thing I would say is, I might be familiar with that article. I mean, I'm not sure if this is brought up, but some of these volume controls have actually been shot down. But I mean, the people affected have voted to either get rid of a marking order or to actually vote to get rid of a particular kind of these provisions specifically. So that's happened. And then since 1995, you probably have additional marking orders that have been added. Since then. So that's something to bear in mind. But even if there are 29, let's say, marketing orders are 20, but most of them don't have those reserve provisions in it. So you can have most of the marketing orders just simply just don't have it. Therefore, how important really are they for these commodities? Did they bring up anything about the volatility of the raisin market in the argument? Is that
not in the argument, no, but it was something that was definitely front and center in the government's brief, and that
okay.
was the whole point of it was to try to restore something like stability after a period of extreme volatility.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
We've got one more comment here. This could be our caller with the citation to the journal article.
Oh, the question about the citation for that law review, the page site was 3, and that was the correct journal site for it.
And it's San Joaquin Agricultural?
Agricultural Law Review
yeah.
3, 1995. Ben Singh is the author.
Terrific. Well, Mr. Elwood, we've got a couple minutes left. If you want to make a concluding remark, I'd welcome that.
Well, I will say that, you know, this it may be unusual for people to venture a prediction. I generally am a little bit circumspect because, you know, sometimes it's very hard to predict. I thought that the Obamacare, the second argument, was fairly hard to read and that, you know, there are some arguments that come out exactly the opposite of the way you would expect them to, like Kylo, if not the takings case, but the thermal imaging case. I would have, you know, guessed the vote of Justices Stevens and Scalia to be the opposite of the way they actually came out based on their composite argument. But this one did seem like a pretty clear one to me. What I'm going to be doing next, though, is I'm going to, you know, take a look at this San Joaquin article, and I may tweet the site because it strikes me as, providing an interesting sort of increase in the amount of actual data on the subject that was somewhat lacking in the argument today. You know, that was the lawyer for the government. I respect him a lot, but he was not long on details on the programs that would be affected by this, and I think that'd be something that would be interesting for people to know.
Well, my thanks to you, John Elwood, for joining us today, obviously for attending the oral argument as well. Hopefully you'll indulge us and come back when we have a decision in this case and give us your readout on the decision.
Sure, be happy to do it.
To our audience, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is Monday, when we'll preview the same-sex marriage arguments happening on Tuesday next week. But until that next scheduled call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.